increasing with every word. "John, dear, I'm ashamed to show you my book, for I've really been dreadfully extravagant lately. I go about so much, I must have things, you know. And Sally advised my getting it, so I did. And my New Year's money will partly pay for it, but I was sorry after I'd done it, for I knew you'd think it wrong in me." John laughed and drew her round beside him, saying good-humouredly, "Don't go and hide. I won't beat you if you have got a pair of killing boots. I'm rather proud of my wife's feet, and don't mind if she does pay $8 or $9 for her boots, if they are good ones." That had been one of her last trifles, and John's eye had fallen on it as he spoke. "Oh, what will he say when he comes to that awful $50? Thought Meg, with a shiver. "It's worse than boots. It's a silk dress," she said, with the calmness of desperation, for she wanted the worst over. "Well, dear, what is the dem total, as Mr. Mantalini says?" That didn't sound like John, and she knew he was looking up at her with the straightforward look that she had always been ready to meet and answer with one as frank, till now. She turned the page in her head at the same time, pointing to the sum which would have been bad enough without the 50, but which was appalling to her with that added. For a minute the room was very still. Then John said slowly, but she could feel it cost him an effort to express no displeasure, "Well, I don't know that 50 is much for a dress, with all the furbelows and notions you have to finish it off these days." "It isn't made or trimmed," sighed Meg faintly, for a sudden recollection of the cost still to be incurred quite overwhelmed her. 25 yards of silk seems a good deal to cover one small woman, but I've no doubt my wife will look as fine as Ned Moffat's when she gets it on," said John dryly. "I know you are angry, John, but I can't help it. I don't mean to waste your money, and I didn't think those little things would count up so. I can't resist them when I see Sally buying all she wants, and pitying me because I don't. I try to be contented, but it is hard, and I'm tired of being poor." The last words were spoken so low she thought he did not hear them, but he did, and they wounded him deeply, for he had denied himself many pleasures for Meg's sake. She could have bitten her tongue out the minute she had said it. For John pushed the books away and got up, saying with a little quiver in his voice, "I was afraid of this. I do my best, Meg." If he had scolded her, or even shaken her, it would not have broken her heart like those few words. She ran to him and held him close, crying with repentant tears, "Oh, John, my dear, kind, hard-working boy, I didn't mean it. It was so wicked, so untrue and ungrateful. How could I say it? Oh, how could I say it?" He was very kind, forgave her readily, and did not utter one reproach. But Meg knew that she had done and said a thing which would not be forgotten soon, although he might never allude to it again. She had promised to love him for better or for worse, and then she, his wife, had reproached him with his poverty, after spending his earnings recklessly. It was dreadful, and the worst of it was John went on so quietly afterward, just as if nothing had happened, except that he stayed in town later, and worked at night when she had gone to cry herself to sleep. A week of remorse nearly made Meg sick, and the discovery that John had countermanded the order for his new greatcoat reduced her to a state of despair which was pathetic to behold. He had simply said, in answer to her surprised inquiries as to the change, "I can't afford it, my dear." Meg said no more, but a few minutes after he found her in the hall with her face buried in the old greatcoat, crying as if her heart would break. They had a long talk that night, and Meg learned to love her husband better for his poverty, because it seemed to have made a man of him, given him the strength and courage to fight his own way, and taught him a tender patience with which to bear and comfort the natural longings and failures of those he loved. Next day, she put her pride in her pocket, went to Sally, told the truth, and asked her to buy the silk as a favor. The good-natured Mrs. Moffat willingly did so, and had the delicacy not to make her a present of it immediately afterward. Then Meg ordered home the greatcoat, and when John arrived she put it on and asked him how he liked her new silk gown. One can imagine what answer he made, how he received his present, and what a blissful state of things ensued. John came home early, Meg gadded no more, and that greatcoat was put on in the morning by a very happy husband, and taken off at night by a most devoted little wife. So the year rolled round, and at midsummer there came to Meg a new experience, the deepest and tenderest of a woman's life. Laurie came sneaking into the kitchen of the Dovecote one Saturday with an excited face, and was received with the clash of cymbals, for Hannah clapped her hands with the saucepan in one and the cover in the other. "How's the little mama? Where is everybody? Why didn't you tell me before I came home?" began Laurie in a loud whisper. "Happy as a queen, the dear. Every soul of them is upstairs a-worshipping. We didn't want no hurricanes round. Now you go into the parlour and I'll send them down to you." With which somewhat involved reply, Hannah vanished, chuckling ecstatically. Presently Joe appeared, proudly bearing a flannel bundle laid forth upon a large pillow. Joe's face was very sober, but her eyes twinkled, and there was an odd sound in her voice of repressed emotion of some sort. "Shut your eyes and hold out your arms," she said invitingly. Laurie backed precipitately into a corner and put his hands behind him with an imploring gesture. "No, thank you, I'd rather not. I shall drop it or smash it, as sure as fate." "Then you shan't see your nevy," said Joe decidedly, turning as if to go. I will. Only you must be responsible for damages." And obeying orders, Laurie heroically shut his eyes while something was put into his arms. A peal of laughter from Joe, Amy, Mrs. March, Hannah, and John caused him to open them the next minute to find himself invested with two babies instead of one. No wonder they laughed, for the expression of his face was droll enough to convulse a Quaker, as he stood and stared wildly from the unconscious innocents to the hilarious spectators with such dismay that Joe sat down on the floor and screamed. "Twins, by Jupiter!" was all he said for a minute. Then turning to the women with an appealing look that was comically piteous, he added, "Take 'em quick, somebody. I'm going to laugh and I shall drop 'em." John rescued his babies and marched up and down with one on each arm, as if already initiated into the mysteries of baby tending, while Laurie laughed till the tears ran down his cheeks. "It's the best joke of the season, isn't it? I wouldn't have you told, for I set my heart on surprising you, and I flatter myself I've done it," said Jo, when she got her breath. "I never was more staggered in my life. Isn't it fun? Are they boys? What are you going to name them? Let's have another look." "Hold me up, Jo, for upon my life it's one too many for me," returned Laurie, regarding the infants with the air of a big, benevolent Newfoundland looking at a pair of infantile kittens. "Boy and girl, aren't they beauties?" said the proud papa, beaming upon the little red squirmers as if they were unfledged angels. "Most remarkable children I ever saw. Which is which?" And Laurie bent like a well-sweep to examine the prodigies. "Amy put a blue ribbon on the boy and a pink on the girl, French fashion, so you can always tell. Besides, one has blue eyes and one brown." "Kiss them, Uncle Teddy," said Wicked Joe. "I'm afraid they mightn't like it," began Laurie, with unusual timidity in such matters. "Of course they will. They are used to it now. Do it this minute, sir," commanded Joe, fearing he might propose a proxy. Laurie screwed up his face and obeyed with a gingerly peck at each little cheek that produced another laugh and made the baby squeal. "There, I knew they didn't like it. That's the boy. See him kick. He hits out with his fists like a good one. Now then, young Brooke,
pitch into a man of your own size, will you?" cried Laurie, delighted with a poke in the face from a tiny fist, flapping aimlessly about.
"He's to be named John Lawrence.
And the girl Margaret, after mother and grandmother. We shall call her Daisy, so as not to have two Megs. And I suppose the Manny will be Jack, unless we find a better name," said Amy, with aunt-like interest.